Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues for our weekly lunch and learn. And we normally do Parshat HaShavua, but today we are going to continue with Haggadah studies, as we did last week. And you got the handouts. Those of you who are watching at home, these are handouts from two new Haggadot. They just came out this year. The good news is the text of the Haggadah hasn't changed, but the commentaries are new. And so we are going to look at a couple of selections from these two Haggadot. One of them, if you look at the packet that I gave you, I'm looking on the one that says on top, Shehecheyanu v'kiyamanu v'higyanu lazman hazeh, who has granted us life, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this time. So this is from a new Haggadah, which is the Eliezer Berkowitz Haggadah. Okay? Eliezer Berkowitz was a very distinguished rabbi who served in Europe and in the United States. I will get you his exact years in a moment. And he lived from 1908 to 1992. He was born in what was the Austria-Hungary Empire, and he died in Jerusalem. And he received his rabbinic training under Rabbi Akiva Glasner, who's the son of Rabbi Moshe Shmuel Glasner, who's more famous than his son. He's most well known for being a disciple of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, known as the Sridei Eish. We're going to study some of his work also. He's called he called his book the Sridei Eish because he was a Holocaust survivor. So a Sarid is a survivor of the fire. And he spent his time in America. In Europe, he taught in the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. In America, he taught at the Theological College in Skokie, Illinois, outside of Chicago. And he wrote some very important books on halacha, including Tanai B'Nisuin V'Get, which is a book that tries to figure out a way to construct a Jewish marriage which would avoid the problem of agunot, women who are unable to get their divorce. He wrote a book about halacha, halacha kocha v'tafkida, which is an expanded version of an English book he wrote called Not in Heaven, The Nature and Function of Halacha. And he wrote a very famous book called Women in Jewish Law. He wrote in Hebrew and in English. He was one of the first to deal with issues related to women in Jewish law, Eliezer Berkowitz. So he never wrote a Haggadah per se, but he has a lot of other writings. And someone who is a someone who studies Eliezer Berkowitz combed through all of his writings and attached some of his writings to different parts of the Haggadah. So it's not a commentary on the Haggadah written as such, but it is a collection of his writings which have been applied to certain parts of the Haggadah. So we're in the packet, the multi-page packet, on the first page where it says, Shehecheyanu v'kiyamanu v'higyanu lazman hazeh. So here, this is at the beginning of the Seder, right? We all know the beginning of the Seder. We say this bracha after we say Kiddush. And we thank God for sustaining us and enabling us to reach this time, as the bracha says. And so here Eliezer Berkowitz does something Again, this is not a commentary on the bracha itself. It's more an understanding of how Jews think of time, right? The unique way that Jews think of time. And generally speaking, we have the present. We're in the present. And then there's the past to think about what happened. And there's the future. And those times are often thought of as mutually exclusive. From living in the present, I'm enjoying the present time right now. I'm not thinking about the past. I'm not thinking about the future. I'm enjoying the moment. It's a very modern, sort of Western way to think. I'm in the moment, and that's what matters. And Eliezer Berkowitz argues that Jews actually think of time very differently. We have much less of an emphasis on the present, with more of an emphasis on the past and the future. And he goes so far as to say that we often live in a way where it seems that the past and the future are coexisting.
That's what the Chazam said.
Is that right?
Chazam was a philosopher, and that's what he said, that the Jewish people, they don't have only present. They have what the majority of their timing is the past and the future.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good. So, and Rabbi Soloveitchik also has a similar notion in his writing. And so I thought we would just read through this, because I think it's really an interesting way to think about time. He says as follows: consider the Jewish stance in history. On the one hand, there is avelut, mourning, of a kind that made manifest complete identification with the past. We do this a lot, right? We have Tisha B'Av, we have the 3 weeks, we have Tzom Gedalia, Shavasar B'Tammuz. Right, we have a lot of mourning, right? In every generation, we saw ourselves as if we ourselves had been exiled from Zion and Jerusalem. Right, those moments, those times in history when we talk about mourning, we don't just talk about mourning in the abstract. We put ourselves in mourning. On Tisha B'Av, we actually observe Shiva. Right, on Tisha B'Av, we do things that people who are sitting Shiva do. We sit on a low chair. We don't wear leather. We don't tear our clothes because it's not a new mourning. It's not a avelut chadasha. It's an old mourning, so we don't tear our clothing, but we are acting like someone who sits Shiva on Tisha B'Av, right? We're acting it out. And we read Eicha, right, as well. Right? We immerse ourselves completely in mourning. Then he says, on the other hand, by the unwavering faith in Geula, we have always identified ourselves with the future. We were so sure that one day the Redeemer would come that at times we felt as if something of the promise had indeed been fulfilled. After the mourning period of the dry vachin, the 3 weeks, and Tisha B'Av, there follows Shabbat Nachamu, the Shabbat of consolation, which we have observed in every kind of exile, as if indeed we have been comforted. Right. So even though, you know, even Jews who are living in exile, still celebrated Shabbat Nachamu, which is hoping something about a few. We're completely ignoring the present. Right? When we think about Shabbat Nachamu, we're ignoring the fact on some level that we are in
still Avilim,
right? Avilim and Galut. So we play with this back and forth idea of Avilut and consolation. But he says there's more. The celebration of the Seder and the observance of the festival of Pesach, Zman Cheruteinu, the season of our freedom, often is in the midst of the most abject oppression, has given the Jew a very real sense of personal redemption. Right, we're all aware of stories of hidden Pesach Seders in the ghetto,
right,
or in a concentration camp, or Spain, right? And it's strange, right? It's one thing for us to celebrate, right, because the galut, and I say that in air quotes, because it's hard to really claim that we are in galut. It's true we are not living in Israel, but for most of us, that's a choice.
Right,
for most, the diaspora Jew, this is the main difference between diaspora Jewry now and any time in the previous
time.
Our being in exile is our choice. Now, I'm not judging people. I'm sitting here with you, right? But we've made a choice, for the most part, not to. Now, some would argue, it's, even though Israel is still galut because there's no Mashiach, there's no Beit HaMikdash, true, but it's not full galut.
They are on the land.
Right, it's not, right, exactly. It's not full galut anymore. And there are fewer and fewer countries where Jews aren't allowed to go freely, right? You mentioned Russia, right? That was a real galut until communism fell, right? So keeping that in mind, right, the celebration of the Seder and the observance of the festival of Pesach, Zman Chayrutenu, the season of our freedom, often in the midst of the most abject oppression, has given the Jew a very real sense of personal redemption. Or again, in the joyous liberation from the burdens of the past year, as the holy day of Yom Kippur comes to its climactic close, the Jew is granted, in anticipation, a measure of bliss of the fulfillment of the times. The weekly Shabbat, too, has granted rest and peace. Me'ein Olam Haba, right? We call Shabbat Me'ein Olam Haba, like a taste of the world to come, as if from the world to come. Right? We're sitting in this world, but we experience Shabbat as something different. On the other hand, complete identification with the past, the origin of our exile, on the other hand, complete identification with the future through anticipatory faith of redemption. So we live in the past and the future simultaneously. On the one side, mourning, on the other, consolation. Past and future, exile and redemption, embracing each other in every present moment. In all the exiles, the Jew has lived in the past and the future more than in the present. They were more important than the present. We have drawn the past from behind and the future from before us and sunk them into the contemporary moment in which we found ourselves in each generation. Thus, living with the past in memory and with the future in faith, we have saved the present from the domination of time. Right? That's very beautiful. Right? The present is, we would normally think that the past and the future are not real, they're fluid. He's saying it's the present which is not real. Right? By living in the past and the future simultaneously, we change the present. Right? We're able to reconstitute and reformulate the way we express the present time. The example of this would be, having a Seder under terrible circumstances. If you were really focused on the present, you wouldn't do it. How could you do a Seder about freedom in the Warsaw Ghetto? It doesn't make any sense. It's what they call, in Talmudic language, tarte desatre. It's two things that are soter one another. They conflict with one another. Doesn't make any sense, right? But if you live in a way where you think about the past and think about the future, and the present is defined by that, then you could pull it off. In every generation, we have succeeded in establishing the present moment as a point in eternity. Without it, we could not have remained on the stage of history. Right? It's another important point about giving up. If Judaism took the present too seriously, we would have given up a long time ago. Right? It's the belief in the future redemption that sometimes allows people to contend with the present desolation. But if we were so focused on the present, we would just give up hope. So, Shechiyanu v'kimanu l'zman hazeh, what has allowed us to come to this time? The fact that we really don't pay so much attention to this time. The fact that we were able to survive so long because we really don't let the present get to us. The present is only a blip. What really matters is our past and our future. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, new holiday that we created, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, is also built on Yom HaZikaron, which is one day before.
Right, okay.
Which is mourning.
Right.
And Yom Ha'atzma'ut, which is looking toward the future.
And right.
So
yeah.
It's a concept of Judaism.
Right. It's interesting. Right. We say the hahove keheref ayin. Right? The present is like the blink of an eye. Now,
but also a lot of mitzvot we have to do because to remember Kigera Eden Beit Mitzrayim, everything
right.
based on the
remembering the past, right?
Knowing our past more than just remembering.
So I thought that was a
built on the past.
A very nice thought. A nice thought. All right, next idea, unrelated. Next page, where it says go and learn. This is the part of the Haggadah we call Tse Ulamad. Ma bikesh Lavan harami lasot liYaakov Avinu, paro lo gazar ela ala zecharim, v'lavan ratza laakor et hakol. Right? And then, this is one of the main parts of the Haggadah, coming after this, where we tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, using verses from Devarim, Deuteronomy.
Because they said it's never late or early.
Well, what would have been more reasonable verses at first glance to use to tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim?
Exodus,
the actual story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, right? We should have opened up at the Haggadah should say at this point, take out a chumash, and go to Chapter 1, 2, 6, 12 of Shemot, of Exodus, and read the story. So why don't we do that? Right? Why do we read, these are verses from Devarim.
Why don't we do
Shemot? Why do we do Devarim?
Yeah.
Right? And the verses in Devarim are the verses that a Jewish farmer would say when he brought his first fruits to Jerusalem for Bikurim. And in there, there's a mention of the Inui, of the suffering and the slavery and the miracles, and God took us out of Mitzrayim. But it is not the narrative. It is a expression of the story, but again, it's not the verses of Shemot. Okay? So, anyone want to... This I'll tell you about this author in a moment, but any suggestions why we do that? It seems if you were writing the Haggadah and you said, okay, at this point we're going to tell the story, we might have said, okay, let's pick out a chapter or two from Shemot.
Or in Bikurim, the Matan Torah.
Hold on, one at a time. Go ahead. Shula, go.
No, I just said that in Bikurim, actually, the Ma'amad Har Sinai.
What do you mean? What is Ma'amad Har Sinai?
Chag HaShavuot.
You mentioned Bikurim.
Yes.
Chag HaShavuot actually based on the historical event of Kabbalat HaTorah.
Right. That's true. There is a connection between Bikurim and Shavuot. So again, the question is, why do we use those
Bikurim
verses?
Because of the season.
But why do we use those verses in the Haggadah? That's the question.
Oh.
As opposed to Shemot verses. Okay, Liora?
Because, at the time, being an emotional situation, but it sounds like it's redemption.
What do you mean, emotional situation? So how does that... So why am I using the Bikurim verses instead of the Shemot verses?
Maybe that's the state of redemption.
Because since they're going, since they're in Eretz Yisrael and they brought the Bikurim, it sort of reminds us of the end of the journey. While had we just used Shemot verses... We don't know at that point. You have to pretend at least. You don't know what the end of the story is. But by the time you're reading the Bikurim verses, those verses are only used once the Jews are in Eretz Yisrael. And so that reminds us that there was a happy ending.
What is the Bikurim verses? What's the text that...
Someone grab a chumash. It's the Arami Oved Avi. Those are the Bikurim that we say. Here, we have. Bring me the Haggadah. Here, give me the Haggadah. These are the verses that are said.
Tse Ulamad.
We have a number of verses. One. Shepara lo gazar ela hazacharim shenemar arami oved avi vayer mitzrayma vayagar sham emtei ma'at vayhi sham legoy gadol. That's one of the section. Then the next section. Then the next section is. Yes, this is from Devarim. These are all from Devarim.
Yeah.
And the next section is. Vayhi sham legoy gadol. Atzum varav vayareo tanu hamitzrim vayanunu. Vayitnu aleinu avodah kasha, vayareo tanu hamitzrim.
That's
not Shemot. No, it's not Shemot.
No,
these are psukim from Devarim. This is what the farmer says when the bikurim are brought. Here, I'll give it to you from the Torah itself. It's from Devarim. That's the whole point, right? They sound like they would be Shemot psukim. But they're not. They're Devarim Psukim. So this is from Devarim chapter 26, Chaf Vav. And this is what is said.
It says,
but it's not. This is not. That's the point. This is not a repetition. That would make sense. We would say, okay, we're going to use the repetition of the story in Shemot, but that's not. This is a speech that is given. Okay. So these are. So that's the question. So I like your answer a lot, Liora. So it's an excellent answer. And let's look at some other answers. So this Haggadah, this copy that you have in front of you, is from a Haggadah written by, a commentary written by Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon. He is currently the rabbi of one of the neighborhoods in Alon Shvut in Israel. He also teaches at Yeshivat Har Etzion. And he... also writes wonderful books of halacha, and he wrote a book of halacha on the Haggadah and a book of commentary on the Haggadah, and this is from the commentary part. So first he asks the question, why do we expound on the verses from Deuteronomy and not from Exodus? At first blush, it would seem that the book of Exodus would be the best way to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. The editor of the Haggadah, though, chose four verses from Parshat Ki Tavo in Devarim, which tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt in much shorter form. Had we wanted to use the verses in the book of Exodus, so that's the question, okay? And so then why? What's the answer? He says one answer is it's practical,
yeah,
right?
It's shorter.
Had we wanted, exactly, right? And we think the Haggadah is too long. Imagine if we used the verses from Shemot. Had we wanted to use the verse in the Haggadah in the book of Exodus, it would have made the Haggadah much longer, and we might have been obliged to skip certain verses. When we use the verses that were chosen, dealing with the first fruits, we can cover the complete story with a relatively short passage. One can fulfill the exposition in the words of the Mishnah that he expounds until he completes the whole section. Okay? So those are the verses. And here are the verses, just to you say. This is what happens. I'll read you the beginning of the parsha in English. It will be when you enter the land of Hashem, your God gives you his inheritance, and you possess it, dwell in it, then you shall take the first of every fruit of the ground that you bring in from the Lord, from the land that Hashem, your God, gives you. You shall come to whoever will be the Kohen in those days, and you shall say, I declare today to Hashem, your God, that I have come to the land that Hashem swore to our forefathers to give you. The Kohen takes the basket from your hand and lay it before the altar of Hashem your God. Then you shall call out and say before your God. Here it is. This is what you say. Pasuk 5. Arami oved avi. Vayered mitzrayma. This is right from the Haggadah. Vayagasham bimtei ma'at. Vayihisham legoy gadol atzum varav. Vayareu otanu hamitzrim. Vayanunu vayitnu aleinu avodah kasha. when it's Akel Hashem Elokei Avotenu, Vayishma Hashem et Kolenu, Vayara et Anyenu, Ve'et Amalenu, Ve'et Lachatzenu, Ve'yotzeinu Hashem Mimitzrayim, Ve'yad Chazaka V'zorna Tuya, Uv'morah Gadol Uv'ototim Ovtim, Ve'yavi'enu El Makom Hazeh. After all of that, God has brought us to this place, Ve'yitein Lanu Et Aretz Hazot, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash.
So in Shmot is while it's happened, and Dvarim is telling about that, that it's
yes, worked. Yeah, right. Oh, we'll get to that. Excellent, Shula. So answer number one is it's shorter. You just had the whole, this is like they tried to beat us, we won, let's eat version, right? Had we gone with Dvarim, Shemot, it would have been much longer. So one is a practical reason. Rabbi Ramon offers a few other reasons. A second paragraph on the left. Another reason for choosing these verses is that the verses in Deuteronomy are part of the commandment of bringing in one's first fruits, whereby each person is required to bring his first fruits and to tell others about the exodus from Egypt. This is a description of the past and a demonstration of how to properly tell over the exodus from Egypt as more than just a description of events that took place. This is what you're saying, Shula.
Yeah.
This is an actual example of how to tell the story. In Shemot, it's not an example of someone telling the story. It's a blow-by-blow narration of what is happening.
Yeah.
It's not what we're supposed to do at the Seder. Uh-huh. What we're supposed to do at the Seder is retell the story. Well, how am I supposed to do that? I have no model. Of course you have a model. Bikurim. Right? So exactly like you said, Shula. So not only is it practical because it's shorter, it actually fits the bill better of what we're supposed to be doing to begin with, which is actually telling the story. So here we have an example.
The Kurim doesn't have to do with the Akedah. I mean, with the present that we are sitting near the table.
No, so that's what he's saying. Meaning, why do we use the Bikurim speech? Because the Bikurim speech is an example of telling the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's all in there. Vayareo Otanu Hamitrim, Vayanunu, Vayetnu Alenu V'dakashav, and Etzakel Hashem. All the elements are there that the farmer has to say to out loud to anyone who's listening. And so it's actually a tutorial, if you will, on how to tell the story.
So really you have to say in Bikurim all the things that would happen?
It's four verses. Four psukim.
When they brought the Bikurim, that's
those four psukim. Yeah, it says, then you shall call out and say before Hashem your God. It says, V'anita v'amarta lifnei Hashem Elokecha. Quote, Arami oved Avi. It's a speech.
It's funny because the way we were taught is this is a secularization of the Shavuot to make it Chag Bikurim. It's not Chag Matan Torah.
It's both. It's Matan Torah. And by the way, in the Chumash, it's not Matan Torah. In the Chumash, it's Bikurim.
They call it Chag Bikurim.
Right, yeah. Okay, next answer. Bottom paragraph.
That's even nicer because that shows you that this chag shows you that Jews belong in the land.
Right, like Leora said. All right, next paragraph, bottom left. One can add another reason. The commandment of bringing...
Where is it?
Bottom left, right here. One can add another reason. The commandment of bringing in first fruits expresses the attribute of gratitude. The person goes down to his field, looks at his crop, and knows that everything is from God. You shall rejoice with all the good that the Lord your God has granted you and your household. In this section, there is one major verb that is repeated time and time again. Nun, tav, nun. Natan. To give. Gives to you appears twice. To give to you, and who gave you the land, God gave, and the Lord your God gave you. By being personally grateful and able to identify with God's abundant generosity, a person learns to thank God for all that he has done for the nation of Israel, for its deliverance, and for its redemption. So again, it's interesting, right? There's nothing in the Exodus narrative that points so directly towards, that's so obviously gratitude. Although we do have Az Yashir, right? The Song of the Sea is part of the Exodus narrative. But here, the gratitude is very explicit. And it also teaches us something. That their one required aspect of the Seder is gratitude, right? According to a number of authorities, if you tell the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim without expressing gratitude, you haven't done the full mitzvah.
Oh,
right. Mm-hmm. And we have gratitude at the end, right? At the end of the Liar Pesta Haggadah again, please. Right, first we have Hallel.
Okay.
We have gratitude.
And I hear who, the song.
And at the end of the at the end of Magid, Lefichach anachnu chayavim lehodot lehallel leshabeach. Therefore, it is our duty to thank, to praise, in song and prayer, lefaer leromem lehader levarech lehallel lekales. To extol, to right, who performed all these wonders for our forefathers and for us. He brought us out from slavery to freedom, etc., etc. Dayenu is another form of thanksgiving in the Haggadah. We have also, earlier, we have an aspect of thanksgiving where we say, Baruch Shomer Haftachato LeYisrael Baruch Hu. Praise is the one who keeps his promise to Israel. Praise be he. We have at least three areas, times in the Haggadah, where we have thanksgiving. And that we learn from the fact that the compilers of the Haggadah chose these psukim to remind us of the importance of Hakarat HaTov.
Oh, Birkat HaMazon is a thank you.
But that's for the food. Well, that's for the food. We also, Anitzia Mitzrayim. Anitzia Mitzrayim, you're right. Right, right, exactly. All right, next one. Finally, one left on the bottom right side. He says as follows. We can offer yet another reason why the Haggadah uses the verses in Deuteronomy instead of those in Exodus. While it is true that the text regarding the first fruits is much shorter than in Exodus, the former text does not look only at the Exodus from Egypt by itself like the latter one does. The recitation upon bringing one's first fruits is also a look backwards, remember we talked about time, and begins the description of the redemption from the time of Yaakov, Arami Oved Avi. That goes all the way back to Yaakov. So that's the question, why are we doing that? We should just be focused on Yetziat Mitzrayim. Why do we go all the way back to Yaakov? One thanks God by examining the course of history of the nation of Israel. This way we understand that there is a divine plan that leads our nation. From the beginning of our forefathers to the present day, our thanks are not only for the exodus from Egypt. The exodus from Egypt is only an example of how God has helped Israel historically throughout the generations, and we thank him at the Seder night for all his help. This is very interesting. This is what you call throwing in the kitchen sink. Right? Once you're ready thanking God for your Yetziat Mitzrayim, right? By the way, where else do we do this? Birkat HaMazon. Yeah. The first bracha is Al Haaretz. Then we have Al Haaretz, Uvenei Yerushalayim. We pack it in to Birkat HaMazon. Most of it is not about food.
Anymore.
Right? Most of it is not about food. Once you're ready thanking, right? So same here. Right? Once we're ready thanking, we have to think about it. What are we thanking for? It's true, Yetziat Mitzrayim, but conceptually, what does Yetziat Mitzrayim represent? Conceptually, Yetziat Mitzrayim represents Yad Hashem. Right? It represents God's hand that's been protecting us and guiding us and watching us. Well, that didn't start at Yetziat Mitzrayim. We actually could argue, why not go back to Avraham Avinu? But we do. When do we go back to Avraham Avinu in the Seder? The very beginning. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoteinu. Avram's father, Terach, was an idolater. So it's the kitchen sinking of theory of kitchen sinking, which we see in a lot of different places. By the way, we do this on the negative too, right? Tisha B'Av is not only the day on which we remember Churban of the Beit HaMikdash. It's every bad thing that happened.
It's Bavel.
Everything bad thing that happened is remembered on Tisha B'Av. Now, some communities like ours added a day, Yom HaShoah. But many communities don't have Yom HaShoah, and Tisha B'Av became the day after the Shoah, since we're already remembering the Churban Bayit, and we're remembering the pogroms, and we're remembering the Crusades. We're going to stick the Shoah in there. And even those of those communities like ours that do have a separate Yom HaShoah, we still add a kina, we add a sad prayer on Tisha B'Av for the Shoah.
Oh.
So we do it both. There are different ones. There are different ones. It depends which machzor, which kina book you have, because those are written, obviously,
you know,
in modern times.
Because that's what shows that he was the farmer and not Jacob.
He was the what?
The farmer. Lavan, Arami, was the farmer.
Why?
Because he did the land. He worked the land.
No, Yaakov was a shepherd.
He was a shepherd. He didn't work the land.
Yeah, so what's the problem?
That's my problem.
What is it? I don't understand.
We don't work the land. It's not ours.
Okay, but but this is stated by farmers. This is stated. Yeah, this is stated by farmers who are working the land, right? The people who are saying this are bringing their first fruits. They're farmers from all over Eretz Israel, who come to Yerushalayim with their first fruits. The whole statement, if you in Devarim, who's saying this?
He wasn't Jewish.
No, but who is saying this? Not Lavan. The Jewish farmer is saying this. Here's what the Jewish farmer says. Arami oved avi, vayered mitzrayma.
The Arami is oved avi.
Wait. That was vayhi sham legoy gadol. That was. Now, what happened? We became a great nation, and then we were in Mitzrayim, and now we were taken out of Mitzrayim, and God brought us to this land, and now He has given us this fruit. So it's saying we are now the farmers. Right, of course, the person who's saying this is the Jewish farmer. Right, exactly. Okay? And I'm not sure where one reads into here that he was a farmer.
Who?
The Arami.
Arami Oved Avi.
No, Arami Oved Avi doesn't. Arami Oved Avi means something else. It means
what?
As follows. It means.
That he was a slave?
Arami Oved, meaning he tried to destroy Avi.
Who is the Arami?
Well, it could be Lavan. Arami Oved Avi is...
No.
That's not what it means. No. Oved, Aleph, Vet, Dalet.
Oh.
Aleph.
He got lost?
Arami, no, La'abed, to destroy. He tried to destroy with an Aleph, not La'avod with an Ayin.
Oved.
Arami, Oved, with an Aleph.
That's what it says here?
It says in the Torah. And I'm assuming, yeah. Okay, good question. All right, let's look at one more thing. This one I really, really liked. I came across this one last night. Let's look at the single page that I handed out. We're going to stick with Lavan.
Which side? Problem with Lavan,
151. On the top right is the page number. Yeah. So what we say about Lavan in the Haggadah is Lavan ratza la'akor et hakol. Right? Paro, it's a very strange thing. Lavan is worse than Paro. Paro only wanted to kill the boys. Lavan wanted to destroy everything. So what does that mean? What's your question? Right. So, what does that mean that Lavan wanted to destroy everything? So, I think the most straightforward. The most straightforward way is at one point he threatens Yaakov with harm. And so maybe we're saying, yeah, Lavan had his way, and had God not protected Yaakov, or had Yaakov not been stronger, Lavan really wanted to do Yaakov harm, and had he done Yaakov harm. That would have been Oker et Hakol, because Yaakov was the next chain, and had Yaakov been killed, there would have been no Bnei Yisrael, because Yaakov is Yisrael, literally. I'll show you later. I wanted to. He talks about harming him, so maybe that's what really Lavan wanted to do, but he didn't. So maybe that's what it means. But in this Haggadah,
that's why he gave him
in this Haggadah of the Sridei Esh, which he has a different interpretation, which is really, I think, very powerful and contemporary. Okay? On the bottom paragraph of the page, based on this, Lavan the Aramean strategy becomes clear. He wished to harm us in the exact spot where he sensed a failure on the part of his family. He attempts to prevent Yaakov from entering the land. That's not what I wanted to do. Here, turn to the next page. On the top right, towards the end of the line, this is how he expresses himself to Yaakov. This is not done in our place to give the younger before the elder in marriage. Remember, he switches Rachel and Leah. And so this is the way Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg explains this. I mean, he says, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg finds it strange that Lavan is lecturing Yaakov on proper etiquette and morality. This is not done in our place to give the younger before the older in marriage. It is as if he is standing watch over the moral code, as opposed to Yaakov, who is asking to breach it. Lavan acts in this way throughout, so Yaakov is forced to act in the manner ascribed to God by David in the following verse, "With the crooked you are subtle." Lavan's crookedness lies in his seeming to stand for morality as opposed to Yaakov. He does so again when Yaakov flees and he chases after him. He comes to Yaakov with a moral rebuke. How can you flee from the very person who has showered you with kindness for 20 years? Isn't that ungrateful of you? Meaning, and he's the one who switched Rachel and Leah, and who Yaakov says, you changed my wages 100 times. You've been unethical to me. But here, Lavan comes along and says, I am the upholder of morality and fairness. And you, Yaakov, you are a thief. You are acting in an inappropriate fashion. Right? How can you flee from the very person who has showered you with kindness for 20 years? Isn't that ungrateful of you? If only you had parted with me as is requisite, I would have gone out to escort you with a marching band. Lavan's tactic for destroying Israel is the most dangerous. And this is where I was reminded of contemporary events.
So where is he threatening to destroy
him? So this is how he's threatening to destroy him. Oh. He sought to uproot everything. He turns the tables, seeming to represent the better and more perfected version of what Israel is supposed to represent. He waves the banner of universal morality. He is the protector of the weak, and the Jewish people who are so sensitive to morality may follow his rather alluring discourse without realizing that it is precisely Lavan and his associates who have chosen the way of trickery and deceit, and it is they who, when put to the test, are able to trample the very morality that they supposedly represent. I have the ability to harm you. This is the verse I was talking about before. Only that God, our forefathers, said to me yesterday, watch yourself from speaking with Yaakov, either for good or for bad. So what I was reminded about of this is the current situation with Israel, right? That people are calling Israel immoral and unethical. No one's suggesting that Israel is perfect. But when you have places like certain countries where, you know, homosexuals are stoned and women aren't allowed to drive and, there's no freedom, calling Israel immoral, right? It's sort of what Lavan was trying to do. Yeah. And that's very dangerous. When you try to convince the world that Lavan was trying to convince the world or his surroundings that Yaakov was the bad guy. When someone tries to convince the world that Israel is the bad guy, that's dangerous for Israel. That could harm Israel. That's what Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg is saying. V'lavan ratza lakor et hakol. When you convince people that someone's not moral, not ethical, that they're the bad person, then people turn on them. When people turn on them, then they are threatened. Their existence is threatened. And that's what
besides
was coming with Yaakov. So I, as soon as I read this, I thought of the current situation where Israel is held to a standard and taken to task for things which are often worthy of consideration, but there's also a double standard, and the world tries to turn Israel into the bad guy. So that was a nice contemporary connection between what Yaakov tried to do and in the Haggadah, and maybe something going on in our own time. So just to review, we did 3 commentaries on the Haggadah. One, we explained what it means to come to a certain time in Judaism. We said that really means to not focus on the present, but to be more focused on the past and the future, and to be able to almost ignore present difficulty with faith in the future. And that a Jew lives in the past and the future simultaneously. Then we talked about, we gave 4 explanations. 4 explanations, including one that was preempted by Leora as to why we use the Deuteronomy, the Devarim verses, which are the Bikurim verses, to tell the story of Egypt and not the Shemot verses. And then, continuing on that same theme within that same part of the Haggadah, what does it mean that Lavan tried to destroy everything? Pshat, the most basic understanding, is that he had the opportunity, if he wanted to destroy Yaakov. He said it many times. I'm sorry about that. He tried. He said, "Had I been given the opportunity, I would destroy you, but I didn't because God protected you." That's what it means. Lavan ratzala kortakol. He really wanted to destroy Yaakov. But we also have this other interpretation of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, where the destruction comes not in physical destruction, but you try to prove that Yaakov, Yisrael, are immoral, and the rest and Lavan and others are the real upholders of righteousness and fairness, and that actually could be very dangerous. And that is something that we actually have seen, at least try to, people have tried to play that out over the course of time vis-a-vis Israel and how Israel is judged. So, okay, that's it for today, everyone.
Okay.
Have a wonderful, wonderful day.